miss a minute. Listen at your leisure, always online and on demand at RadioMD.com. You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show with Dr. Michael Roizen, MD.
And this is Dr. Mike. You're listening to You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show with me, Dr. Mike Roizen. And it is a live show. You can call in if you've got questions, 844-305-7800. My sister, Marsha Lowry, who lives in Connecticut, where we're going to be celebrating Thanksgiving, emailed me during the break and said, I'm preparing the turkey following your instructions. You might want to tell people you won't be live. In fact, next week we won't be live, but it won't be a repeat show. I'm pre-recording one before I go to her place, so Wednesday evening I'm pre-recording, and we've got sensational guest for you. I'll tell you about it, him in a few minutes, but it's a sensational guest we got lined up. So although there are about three shows in the next 6 weeks that we will not be doing live, they all will be new shows with the latest medical information and new guests. We're just going to pre-record them rather than do it. So, Marsha, thank you for the note. But we have right now to switch topics and go to a new project, the Cornell Alliance for Science, which hopes to improve science-based agricultural communication through biotechnology. And Sarah Davidson-Evanega, and Sarah, correct me on that pronunciation, is the director of the Cornell Alliance for Science and the Senior Associate Director of International Programs in Cornell's College of Agriculture and Life Science. And she's going to talk to us about the importance of understanding food knowledge and food science and the communication about that. She actually completed her BA in biology at Reed College, which is in Oregon, and lured by, this is funny, but this is what her statement says, lured by great weather, plenty of water, and an unbeatable intellectual environment, she went from Cornell, she went from Reed to Cornell for her PhD, and has remained after there to help lead a global project on protecting the world's wheat from wheat stem rust. Sarah now serves as the principal investigator and director for the Cornell Alliance for Science. Sarah, thanks very much for coming on, and I really, really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Dr. Mike. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Tell me, let's go right into, I'm going to talk first about the salmon that got approved last week. The salmon that the FDA said we can have, this farm-raised, if you will, engineered salmon. And tell us what's different about it and why we should be happy about it.
Yeah, so it was a big week last week. As you say, the first genetically engineered animal food crop, food product was approved for human consumption. And it's an Atlantic salmon modified for fast growth. And it has, its modification is two genes from two different fish, a Chinook salmon and the ocean pout. So fish genes going into a fish, if you like, nothing too dramatic. And what we have here is a GMO that can benefit both people and the environment. So to date, most of the other genetically engineered foods that have been approved for use in the U.S. have really benefited farmers more than anyone. And here we really have a consumer oriented trait, so we can grow healthy fish in less time with less feed and less inputs. And so it's a win for the consumer in the form of a healthy, better access to a healthy fish. And it's also a win for the environment because we will have less pressure on wild fish stock. So it's a really exciting day.
Now, the question we have, which is one that I had as well, but from a listener, Tom says, does it produce or does it have the same quality of fats as wild salmon?
Right. So there's no substantial difference in the fish that we'll consume, whether it's a farm-raised salmon that we might have in our grocery store today, or this kind of salmon that's grown on land in tanks or wild salmon. They're all good nutritious sources of protein.
Well, they may be good nutrition. Now, what is different about every other fish? Only salmon and ocean trout have avoided learning how to eat corn and soy meal. And the corn and soy meal changes the fat content of the others. So the DHA, the healthy omega-3 in fish oil, that has gone down substantially in all fish but salmon and ocean trout. So what you're saying is these fish aren't going to be fed and haven't learned with those genetic modifications to eat corn and soy meal, so they will still have the same healthy fats.
That's right. They'll still have the same healthy fats.
Okay. So, because we've been trying to find that out for, believe it or not, 2 years since this company announced they were going to go to the FDA with this, and haven't been able to find out whether these salmon, different from, if you will, farm-raised salmon. Farm-raised salmon are the only fish that have not learned to eat corn and soy meal. And so I was just hoping that this modification didn't teach them that they could eat corn and soy meal and develop different fats in their content.
The modification really is just about growing faster with fewer inputs. And that helps.
So the modification was in a growth hormone, if you will, gene that doesn't turn off, if you will, the way normal salmon and even the farm-raised salmon turn off their growth hormone, as I understand it.
That's right.
Okay, so talk to us about, now, when I was growing up, the population time bomb and the lack of food for feeding the population was a big item that was one of the things we talked about, and in fact we're saying this is going to be an issue, that we aren't going to have enough food. What's happened over the last 30 years to food and farmers' efficiency?
Well, I mean, I think you said it yourself. I mean, we really need to be able to produce more food with less inputs, with less negative impact on the environment, and using less land and less natural resources. And that's, I mean, just to go back to the Aqua Advantage salmon that we were just talking about, that's one of the benefits, that you can, you know, grow this salmon and produce more salmon meat for our growing population that, you know, increasingly does want to have a meat-based, protein-rich diet. And so this is an example where you can basically increase the efficiency of growing that protein source. And that's what we need to do. And we need to do that in animals, and we also need to do it in plants. So what we really believe is an important part of the solution to feeding a growing population is to be able to use and harness science and new innovations in order to grow more food with less resources. So we need to intensify production. We need to do it smart. We need to do it with the new tools that we have at our disposal.
When we come back, what I want to ask you about is the other side, or the question everyone has is, what about the dangers of genetically modified organisms? Is there any, in your opinion? What are we doing to monitor and to control that danger, if there is some? And then the other question we have from a Thomas R. from Florida is, he has emailed in and said, is there a risk to Roundup? Since that's part of the genetically modified soy and corn meal, he has indicated. So when we come back, we're going to get to those questions with Sarah Davidson Evanega, the director of the Cornell Alliance for Science.
You're listening to You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show, starring Michael Roizen, MD.
RadioMD.com.
Here's Dr. Mike.
And this is Dr. Mike. We've been talking with Sarah Davidson Ibeniga, the director of the Cornell Alliance for Science and the senior associate director of international programs in Cornell's College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. She's been talking to us, and by the way, the email for her area, www.allianceforscience.cornell.edu. She's been talking to us about the risks and benefits of genetically modified food. One of the strong benefits is it helps eliminate hunger and undernourishment for 795 million people who are in that situation today. So, and one of the risks we obviously get brought up is genetically modified food a risk? And if so, what are we doing to monitor that risk? So, Sarah, can you help us address those?
Sure. So, we have a great regulatory system in this country, and that those agencies monitor carefully and make sure that nothing unsafe gets out into the food supply. And we've been living with GMOs for a few decades now, and there's zero evidence in science that GMOs are harmful to human health. So we can feel good about that. On the contrary, we know that there are a lot of dire consequences to food insecurity, and we know that there are a lot of dire consequences to some of the pesticides that the use of GMOs can actually help displace. So there are GMOs out there that reduce the need or eliminate the need for insecticides, for example, that do have negative impacts on human health. So, for example, we can control the diamondback moth for cabbage growers using genetics instead of insecticides. Or there's a beautiful case in Bangladesh, for example, where an insect-resistant eggplant dramatically reduces the need for pesticides. And as a result, has a real boon for farming families in Bangladesh.
So one of the concerns is that WHO declared Roundup, which is used in much higher concentrations, if you will, and by individuals locally in the concentration they said, but they declared Roundup as a probable carcinogen, meaning likely to cause cancer with use. And so the question is, don't some of these, at least I understood that whether it was corn or soy, with that is GMO modified so that Roundup is effective with it in eradicating pests. Is that a concern? Should we worry about that?
Well, let's remember what else is a probable carcinogen. The coffee you drink, I mean, lots of other things that are part of our life. And other agencies in Europe, for example, their food safety organization has declared that it's not a threat to our health. And so there's a lot of controversy around that statement. But I think what we need to remember is that when we consume genetically modified corn or genetically modified soy, we're not consuming glyphosate. So that is a fairly benign agricultural herbicide that is much less than the chemicals that it replaced. And so it's used to eliminate weeds in fields, but it's not actually something that we consume when we consume the processed food that contains corn and soy. So we have to keep that in perspective. And it's also important to remember that, you know, not all GMOs are created equal. We hear a lot about Roundup Ready and herbicide tolerant corn, for example, or soy, but there's a lot of other products out there that people haven't heard about and are great examples of how genetic engineering can both improve the environment and provide benefits to consumers, and especially provide benefits for smallholder farmers in the developing world. So we don't want to get hung up on this, you know, controversy about glyphosate when there are a lot of other GMOs out there that have really some great benefits to the environment and to people.
Do you think the question came in from a Mary, and she emailed in and said, why should not or shouldn't we have GMOs labeled so we can make decision of whether we want to spend extra money eating non-GMOs? Is there a reason why that shouldn't occur?
Why we shouldn't have labeling?
Yeah, in other words, she said,
I think labels can be really useful tools for consumers. But we want to promote evidence-based decision-making, both at, you know, a policy level as well as at the consumer level. And so what I would say is that if we're going to have labels, they need to be labels that are based in science and that really help consumers make good decisions. So if we're going to label something, let's make sure it's a smart label that really helps consumers make good choices.
Well, don't we want also to let people make decisions based on their own, if you will, influences? So in other words, what Mary said is we don't have GMOs around for long enough. And I don't know whether this is true or not, but she said some GMOs we have not had around long enough that I want to know about them, just like I want to know about the country of origin of the food I eat, since she said it's probably much safer in the United States than food raised in Chile or Mexico, or fruits or vegetables raised in Chile or Mexico. One, is that right, that food is safer in the United States when grown in the United States? And two, should she have the right to know that, do you think?
Well, I don't want to make any broad sweeping statements about the safest origin of food, but I do think that you know, consumers are curious about a lot of different aspects of their food, and certainly the organic label has given a lot of consumers some confidence in knowing about the cultivation methods that are used when the food is grown. But you know, there's chemicals natural chemicals used in organic production too. So what the caller might be curious to know is, you know, what kinds of pesticides are you know, approved for use for organic growers versus what kinds of pesticides are approved for use for conventional growers. And then what I would encourage your listener to think about is what GMOs are out there that actually reduce the need for pesticides, because that's the kind of GMO that really is organic in spirit, where you are actually using fewer chemicals to produce food.
We've been talking, and I want to thank Sarah Davidson Evanega, and the way you get in touch with her, www.allianceforscience.cornell.edu, allianceforscience.cornell.edu, trying to shed light on GMOs and the value they have in helping us reduce the overall burden of pesticides and other chemicals for making sure we have enough food for all of us and food that's economical. We'll be back with the second hour of You, the Owner's Manual radio show.